federal tax developments for the week of July the 27th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this week we're going to be looking at some developments we've had over the week in taxes, and we'll start with kind of a non-development so far. We're still awaiting a bill to come out of the Senate to get our way underway for what is expected to be the most recent COVID-19 relief bill. And we'll talk a little bit about what may be in that bill, or at least what may be in the Senate version, and then we'll have to see how the Senate and House work out with each other. We'll also talk about the SBA announcing the date on which they will begin looking at lenders information, where lenders have decided in favor of or against granting forgiveness for a PPP loan. This obviously, until the SBA starts looking at those things, we're not going to have any actual relief. I'll also briefly discuss the article from the Journal of Accountancy that describes an AICPA town meeting where they discuss that maybe applying for forgiveness right away is not the best idea. We'll talk a little bit about the IRS releasing some numbers for the Affordable Care Act premium tax credit for 2021, the percentages. And then we'll close with two cases. We'll look first at a case under Section 170, the third time we've discussed this same taxpayer going to court, and they lost the prior two. We'll look at whether the third is a charm or whether we just have consistency and they lose again. And then we'll also talk about a case that went up on appeal that we discussed earlier that went up to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit ended up coming up with the same idea the tax court did about this particular taxpayer and whether they had a deductible loss on a 1231 sale of a 1231 asset, whether they had a, we should say, capital loss, which was going to be limited to $3,000 per year from the sale of what was not a 1231 business asset. Well, we'll start with what we thought was going to happen this week, which was we were supposedly, as Congress came back from their recess, the Senate, in theory, had been working over the recess on a proposal for their offer under the COVID-19 relief provisions. The Republican caucus was, on paper, everybody assumed, going to be delivering their version of the bill on Monday. It would be their response to the bill the House passed, which was called the HEROES Act, that was passed back in mid-May. The Senate had waited, they said, to see how things developed, and then they were going to come up with their offer. But it turned out to be a little more complicated than we thought. Well, Monday came and went, and we obviously did not have a bill. And what begins happening is there's a bit of a problem getting the conference and the administration, because, you know, if your party controls the White House, it's kind of nice to have the White House go along with you, come up with an agreement on how they would respond to the proposal out of the House. Now, the House proposal is one that's where the cost is pegged at about $3 trillion. The Senate has told us that their plan is going to cost only $1 trillion, so it's nice to know that that's considered frugal in today's world, but, you know, okay, we're going to have $1 trillion. But nevertheless, they're having real trouble coming to an agreement. We were told essentially that they were going to have the bill. We actually were told Wednesday night that they had an agreement and we'd have a bill on Thursday, and then the day kept wearing on Thursday. Now we're being told that the actual language will come out on Monday, July the 27th, after the administration reviews the language. Now, of course, it's kind of interesting if you're going to say it's going to come out on Monday after they review the language. Well, what if they find something they don't like? You know, does that mean that we, you know, do we change the language? And yeah, so we'll watch for it. Hopefully, if you're listening to this on or after July 27th, we'll know the answer, and hopefully we have something out there so the process can get underway, because until we get this particular bill in place, even if it can't pass the Senate, this would be the beginning point for negotiations between the Senate and the House. And in fact, not sure the Senate will even try to pass this bill. Obviously, the Democrats could shut the bill down if they just decide they don't want to have a vote on it. And since they haven't been consulted about the bill, the likelihood of any of them voting for it is relatively low. So we'll take a look and see how that goes. But presumably right now, we've had complaints from a number of Republican senators At least three, by my count, have openly complained about the bill. Senator Cruz from Texas has had complaints, though he hasn't actually said he won't vote for it. Senator Johnson from Wisconsin has not been happy about the bill, and Senator Paul from Kentucky. And Senator Paul and Senator Johnson have seemed to have indicated that they're not about to vote for the bill. If Senator Cruz also says no, that gets us down to just, a 50-50 vote. Now, obviously, if the White House is in favor, we would assume the vice president would vote in favor of it, and it could pass by one vote. But again, it's going to be one of those interesting asides, and whether or not they even want to try for that vote, that'll be kind of open. But let's talk about what we may be seeing, because that's actually our issue for our clients. What types of things are there? Now, remember, since this is going to be the Republican offer effectively countering the Democratic offer that was what passed the House, this is kind of a starting point. In essence, if you take the House bill and you take the Senate bill, you're looking for things that are in both bills, because those seem to have a really good chance of making it into a final law, so when we get one. And then you figure that we're going to get the actual answer will be somewhere between these two bills, so that we're, it's not going to be exactly what the Senate passes. It's not going to be exactly what the House passes, but it would be somewhere in the middle. Now, last we heard, although it's now been rumored yet again that maybe it'll change, but we were told multiple times the end of last week that there will be no payroll tax holiday or payroll tax rate reduction in this bill, that was not part of what the Senate had agreed to. Now, that said, there has been some rumblings from the White House that it might be back on the table, so we'll have to see what happens. But for the moment, it seems like there's a high probability that it won't be in there, because it does not seem like there's a lot of support in the caucus for the payroll tax cut rules, and it would be difficult. The only way I think it gets there is if the White House convinces them that there is no way that they're going to approve the bill without it. But even in that case, the problem is it doesn't seem likely the Senate, that basically we're going to see much give on this all, either in the House. But, we may have some other things happening here. We may see some expansion of the employee retention credit. That is in the House bill. The House bill would let the ERC be used by employers that had gotten a PPP loan. Right now the rule is if you get a PPP loan, you can't use the employee retention credit. The other thought in the House bill was to expand it by allowing people to qualify for it with a lower level of sales losses. Now, this might dovetail because the Senate is rumored to be wanting to see some sort of credit or incentive to be paid to get companies to hire people back, build employment. And this could very well fit within that. So that may be possible there. We'll see how that goes. We are fairly likely, it appears, to have some sort of second version of the PPP loan program. It does not look like it's going to just be more mods to the first one. It looks like we'll have a second set of loans, that these loans can go to people that already received the first set. But there's a lot of talk in this case that you might have to show some harm. Specifically, what's been discussed multiple times is having to show some sort of drop in revenue. I would suspect they may very well borrow the employee retention credit method and look for a quarterly drop over the prior year in order to justify, giving you the second loan. But it is a problem. We are beginning to see unemployment applications went up last week. So that's concerning. A lot of companies should be running out of their PPP loan money. We're seeing that the coronavirus cases have gone up in certain states, my state being one of them, and that has had an impact on companies trying to ramp back up again. And so it's expected that we may need another program to work it. One thing that also appears to be in this thing is another round of checks to taxpayers. The White House is definitely behind that one. It appears the Senate will go for it. It is in the House bill. The House actually gets more generous. The Senate probably won't get more generous to start with, but we'll have to see what comes out. But yes, there'll probably be another set of checks. And then there'll be other tax credits probably aimed at reopening and COVID-19 prevention costs. So things for people that are restarting their business, expenses incurred in that, and expansion incurred maybe potentially for modifications you're putting in order to help contain the spread of COVID-19, giving businesses credit for those expenses. They may be modifying, you know, their heating and cooling systems. They could be putting up some plexiglass dividers, you know, various things like that that you would grant a credit for. They have a fairly hard deadline to pass of August the 7th, because that's the date that the Senate is scheduled to adjourn for their August recess. I happen to be a little cynical, believing that the Senate, the last thing any senator wants to do, at least the third that are running for re-election, is lose time to go back home and get on the local TV stations, radio stations, etc. I realize with COVID-19 out there, probably not going to have very many huge campaign rallies. You know, they might be tough to get a big group at, but we'll probably have at least. But they still would like to get back home. You know, get on the local television, get on the local radio, talk to the local papers, and do all that sort of thing. You know, showing their back home and, you know, meeting the people, etc. So I suspect they'll go with that. But there's another issue to watch this week. The unemployment additional $600 amount and other special rules that were added to unemployment compensation as part of the CARES Act do expire on the 31st of July. There is some idea that there may be some sort of extension passed if they cannot get an agreement. Whether that extension, now totally clear that the, you know, the Senate does not want to just see the $600 added back in. They want to see a reduction. Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin is suggesting they're looking at replacing about 70% of the earnings of somebody who is laid off. How they do that's open. There's a lot of concern about how we'd get it done. To be totally honest, it was the Secretary of Labor Scalia, that had essentially told Congress in the first try that there was no way the states would be able to actually do something like tie it to actually what somebody earned. Now, whether they've had time enough now and they could do it or other things could happen is open, but the Senate is also reported working on that. But if they can't get a whole deal done by 8-7, it wouldn't be terribly surprising to see them either. And remember, they got to get this through the House too, if they're going to do it. So if they're going to do a short-term patch, perhaps get the House to agree, you know, go with the $600 and extend that for a couple of weeks, and then try to get a solution going forward. The rumor mill this week had been that they'd also like to tag a couple of other items on that bill. My guess is the House will not let them do that, because if they get the key things out of the way in theory, then they don't need to worry about the rest of the bill. So my guess is that you'll probably do a patch for unemployment only, but keep your eye on it. We expect there to be some sort of new law. You know, this should be the last major bill before the election in this area, although obviously it depends on what happens. If things go downhill rapidly, then you may see them back in again working a bill. But a lot of people do think this will be the last bill, but it means one more set of bills and one more set of law changes we'll have to keep our eye on. Now, that said, I'm keeping my eye on how this goes. I'm looking at potentially trying to put together at least a few, with a few state societies, some sessions to go over whatever new law might appear. Of course, right now, I can't give you any idea about when such a course would be, even how long it would be, because we don't know what's even in the bill yet. So we have a few issues, but we are looking at least doing some of those sessions coming up. And I am doing an update session for New Jersey for the next month. So if we do have a bill, that one for sure would contain it. But I'm looking at a couple of other states to maybe try to work out something if we do get a brand new bill. So that hopefully we have some time, preferably they pass it early enough in October, that we can do this well before the 15th of October, I'd love to, and or at least shortly thereafter, not October, 15th of August, because of course we start getting too close shortly after that to the beginning of the absolute drop-dead deadline dates for calendar year entities, the pass-throughs on the 15th of September, the trusts and estates on the 30th of September if they're calendar year estate, and for these and for C corporation individuals on October 15th. So yeah, we'd like to get things up and running before then if we can, especially if anything that is retroactive to 19, which could still happen, you know, shows up in the bills. So keep your eyes on this. Well, let's talk about our developments this week, okay? At this point, let's talk about the SBA came out with a procedural notice, which was entitled Procedures for Lender Submission of Paycheck Protection Program Forgiveness Decisions to SBA and SBA Forgiveness Loan Reviews. They published this on the 24th of July. And from our standpoint, you know, there may be some people here who are with lenders. And if you're with a lender, this is a document to take a look at in total if you're working with the program. But since most of the people, I assume, on this broadcast are working with the borrowers, this document's not really key for the borrower except for one thing. You know, this gives us a starting date for when the SBA would consider starting their review of a lender's determination that a loan shall or shall not be forgiven. Now, they're saying they're going to receive these applications under a brand new system they have set up, and they'll begin it on August the 10th. However, it does say unless things change. Now, some things could change, but obviously be a new law that makes changes in how this works. The document makes it very clear, and I want to make it clear to you too, if you're just representing borrowers, this document doesn't really tell you a whole lot, because this is not the program the borrower will go through. A borrower is going to just submit their application to lenders. Now, lenders, most of them are not yet ready to receive applications. My guess is this thing giving it a date of the 10th tells lenders they probably will get set up. Now they have something on the back end to work with. So you may see some lenders start accepting applications maybe, you know, somewhere in the first week of August or shortly thereafter. They'll begin accepting those so they have something to submit on August the 10th. So we will see that if you really want to get it done, that may come in here. But the Journal of Accountancy this week published an article that actually looked at the question of, with the PPP loan forgiveness, do we need to rush right now out and apply for forgiveness? This was based on one of the AICPA's town hall presentations. In essence, so they came out and they discussed on the town hall some of these issues. And one thing, a couple of things they point out to remember. First thing, they pointed out that this whole process, you have 10 weeks, or I should say 10 months, not 10 weeks, 10 months from the end of the covered period to make your application, because you won't be forced to pay until then. As long as you make it before the 10 months are up, the, you know, the application for forgiveness, you won't have to start paying until they make their decisions, yes or no. Ultimately, we get the final decision. So, okay, you know, that means that we don't really have to fall all over ourselves to do it, to get it done. They also pointed out that there's a lot of unanswered questions. And for instance, we don't know the law that they're going to pass, probably going to pass in August, you know, could very well change the program again. There is a lot of discussion of giving some sort of automatic forgiveness to people below who have loans below a certain level. The number that gets discussed the most often is $150,000 loans. Obviously, if you get that automatic forgiveness, then you don't really need to spend a whole lot of time collecting all the data that you'd have to submit to the bank. You know, and now it depends on whether the automatic is, yeah, you're automatic, but we're going to select some of you to prove it, in which case then you probably better go get that data to back it up, or whether it's really going to be just purely automatic. We're just going to do it, going to ignore you totally. So just go ahead, say, I want forgiveness, and we're done. We'll have to watch for that. We also have some problems here. For instance, they point out a few things. Like, we don't know for sure how broad is the definition of utilities. You know, we know that utilities are a covered expense and that one we can count, at least in the 40% part. You know, up to 40% of our costs can be non-payroll costs. Utilities are part of that non-payroll cost, the allowed non-payroll costs. But we don't really know how far it goes when you start getting outside some of the very basics besides things like electricity, right? You know, electricity counts, you know, basically heat, you know, let's say fuel counts, we were told, you know, internet counts, but we're not told about where we divide where we draw the line on some of these things. How far out can we go? You know, for what? Fuel for delivery trucks, fuel for salespeople's cars, fuel for the officers' cars, fuel for a car we provide to somebody, we're including part of their W-2. You know, we don't know how that's going to go. We also need some additional clarification on these various FTE exceptions that can get us out of having to repay the loan and either fully or partially you know, get rid of that reduction of forgiveness for a drop in FTE. We need to have some clarifications, including the one that was added by the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act, where we were unable to return to our prior level due to complying with certain rules related, certain federal guidance related to sanitation and control of COVID-19. You know, what exactly does that cover and what situation? We have some clarifications. And then also, you know, how exactly do self-employed borrowers end up showing that they had enough, that they, you know, they have their income reimbursement? How do we prove that's paid? All of that is stuff that we need to have some guidance for. So the bottom line, the article came to the conclusion that for a lot of people, it may be best to wait until at least we see what comes in the new law and we see maybe if there's some additional guidance, because the AICPA again stated that they've been told the SBA is sitting on a whole bunch of frequently asked questions that they plan to post up on their website, but they've been sitting on them because they're concerned about the law change. So, you know, we may see a lot of guidance come out in August that may clarify some of these issues. So just kind of look at it, take a look at it, make your decision. But yeah, it's kind of useful to understand there may be a good reason to want to wait a little bit. Next up, we have Revenue Procedure 2020-36, issued on the 21st of July. Now, this is the annual revenue procedure that sets the 2021, it's next year's, percentages for the premium tax credit for somebody getting their coverage from the exchange, right, and gets a subsidy. So that's those that are below 400% of the poverty level, and, you know, they're what they need to deal with. Now, the required contribution percentage for 2021, that is the percent of income that is generally considered an affordable offer from the employer, right? Did the employer make you an affordable offer of coverage? That's going to be 9.83%. There's a demand of more than 9.83% of your salary, then it was not affordable. We also are going to get an updated applicable percentage table. That table tells us how much credit we get, right, for that issue. Do we have a credit? Now, we have these kind of interesting issues. The credit, which is available in the materials, it's also, if you're watching the video one of this, it's on the screen right now. You know, it runs on how much of your income you're supposed to pay and compared to the second lowest cost, silver policy offered in the person's area on the exchange, that they get a credit for the difference between in this case, if you're up to 133% of the poverty level, it'd be 2.07% of your household income times 2.07 household income. That amount is how much you're supposed to pay if you're buying the silver, the second lowest cost silver, so you'd get that credit. Now, as we're all aware, if you buy a better policy, you've got to eat that difference yourself. They only subsidize the second highest cost silver. If you buy the lowest cost silver, second lowest cost silver, I should say, if you buy the lowest cost silver, then you'll get less of a credit. If you buy the bronze, obviously you generally get less of a credit, right? So we're not going to put cash in your pocket directly, but we are going to subsidize it. Now that rises up as we start rising our percentages per the table, and eventually gets to 9.83% for those between 300% and 400% of the poverty level. They have to do the full 9.83, and they'll get a credit for the rest. So that table's there. Remember, from a planning standpoint, what's been kind of interesting, more than a few people have reported, having clients, let's say, who are close to these numbers, where they've discovered doing something like making a deductible IRA contribution actually ends up saving them more on the healthcare than if they didn't. You know, if they don't make that and don't put the IRA money away, they have to pay more than that contribution in to the government because they got too much of a subsidy, or they lose the credit that they could have gotten to subsidize that. So it's always interesting watching with that if you deal with it. I don't deal with it terribly often. Most of my clients don't deal with this credit very often. But if you do, be aware those numbers are out there for 2021. Next up, we have the third time we have visited this taxpayer, Belleair Woods LLC versus Commissioner. It is Tax Court Memorandum 2020-112, July 22nd, 2020. All of these cases have dealt with different issues, You know, this exam of Beller Woods is going around over a qualified conservation easement, or at least what Beller Woods says is a qualified conservation easement. Now, we've covered them twice before, once in January of 2020, that a court case, and then in September of 2018. And in both cases, they've ended up on the losing end with the IRS. But again, we keep looking at different issues. And they've had, you know, losses in both cases. The IRS moves for summary judgment, and the court keeps granting it to them on the issue. This time, we're looking at the question of the specific actual deed that was issued for this conservation easement. And the question was, you know, did this deed meet the requirements? One of the key requirements here is that a conservation easement, right, it needs to grant a right in perpetuity to the charity. So basically, in this case, they say, you know, the certain things shall not be developed, certain changes shall not be made, so that the area remains unspoiled. Let's say that this woodland area remains unspoiled, and so there are certain things that the developer has agreed when they contributed it to, you know, give this to the charity and have the charity enforce it, that they cannot make these changes. So they made that contribution of an easement, and based on that, they took a charitable contribution deduction. But the perpetuity one has become an issue in a number of cases. And the catch is here. The specific issue here deals with the question of, I can't really assure that, let's say, you know, the state decides they are going to, let's say, you know, it's on a river or whatever, that they need to do a flood control project. And in order to do that project, they're going to take the parcel in question, right? Eminent domain, it'll be sold. And so the conservation easement will be lost because, you know, the property will be forced to be sold. Now, if that happens, the law says, we understand that could happen, and there's no way you can directly stop it. But you have to have a clause protect the charity at that point, which says essentially that if the property sold, the charity shall get at least proportionately, you know, their proportionate share of the sales proceeds, which is based on the value of the easement versus the value of the property. And the question became whether, in this case, the deed managed to cover that. And there were two issues that the IRS had with this deed. One of which said that you would get that sort of calculation, you take your sales price, but only after the satisfaction of any and all prior claims. Okay, so we have that. The IRS objected there, said, no, it has to be based on fair value, not based on fair value reduced by prior claims. And then the other catch was that we would also, in determining this fair value, to be multiplied by that portion of the item that represented the contribution, we would, in essence, reduce that by the increase in value of any improvements made to the property after the, you know, after we had donated it. And again, the IRS objects the same, says that that's not a percentage of the sales proceeds. You know, that's that we're reducing the sales proceeds by something we're not allowed to reduce. Now, the tax court had, and I made it very clear here, they actually had decided in a number of prior cases, you know, that essentially this type of restriction, these types of issues don't work. But they said in this case, though, Bel Air had raised some new issues. And since they had raised new issues, we were going to go ahead and deal with them. Well, let's talk about some of the issues they raised. One of them they raised was that in another conservation easement case, in a district court case in Arizona, and these guys not in Arizona, these guys were not part of that case. This is an unrelated case where things obviously got published about what went on and happened, that the IRS had agreed in this case, there, and the real fight with the case in Arizona, apparently, as described by the court, was that the deed originally, you know, had apparently had nothing about this, totally missed it. Then the deed was modified similarly to the one we're seeing here, right, to allow them that if it was for sale, they would get that proportion. And they said, well, in that case, the IRS, you know, in litigation, right, essentially agreed to a stipulation that that particular revised language would be fine They were fighting over whether it, you know, they're saying that revised language is irrelevant because, you know, they have to be bound by the agreement they had, they actually entered into when they made the contribution. Now, eventually that case gets settled, again, doesn't actually go to trial. But Beller Wood says IRS cannot change their mind. You know, they already said it was okay over here. Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago about this whole issue of judicial estoppel. And, you know, we talked about there how that even though the IRS had conceded in the Audio-Technica case, that they had conceded an issue related to the research credit in three prior years' exams prior to the case going to tax court. So they had conceded, and they had conceded the same basic item at the same level. The tax court ruled that that did not bind the IRS in the case in front of, or I should say in this case, it was a district court case, in the case in front of the district court. It did not keep the IRS from arguing those numbers were wrong. The court had said the court never decided. Judicial estoppel only matters if you have had a judicial determination, you know, that you're now trying to argue inconsistently with and you benefited from that before. They're saying in this case, there was no determination ever made because everything got settled. It didn't matter. And the court never really looked at that issue. Now, in this case, the court said, well, this is a similar theory. But the real problem we've got here is, despite the regular issues we've got to worry about for, you know, judicial estoppel, worrying about the fact of taking that inconsistent position we talked about before, if it's an unrelated taxpayer, you know, an unrelated party, it's a case that you are not a party to. If that is the case, then we have other things that are here, right? You have to essentially say that the IRS took an inconsistent position under oath in a separate proceeding, and the inconsistent positions were calculated to make a mockery of the judicial system. So they have to meet the same requirements we talked about before, and basically it has to make a mockery of the system to go the other route. And the court said, no, the IRS made a strategic decision to concentrate on the issue they felt they had a better chance of winning, right? They, you know, the court never decided, never did the court render a decision on whether this deed was good or not. The fact the IRS chose not to fight it there does not mean they can't fight it in another case, right? Just like the fact that, let's say, the Arizona, you know, the Arizona Highway Patrol, DPS here, does not, you know, stop every car going over the speed limit driving between Phoenix and Tucson on I-10. Does not somehow make it okay for you to have gone over the speed limit on that same route, even though somebody else said, I was going 80, but so was this other guy. It's like, yeah, it doesn't matter. That we, you know, we can prosecute you. You know, that's fine. Not there. They also had a really weird one. Well, they had a couple of things. They also said, well, the improvements weren't really part of the donation, right? You know, that we just donated the land. But the court said that wasn't really consistent with anything in the deeds or other documents that suggested that the improvements were not considered part of what had been donated. It was not just the land that was there. Finally, they said, and this one, I really don't know why they thought this would win, but it was that they said, well, it doesn't matter anyway, because the improvements are worthless, would be worthless, could never be worth anything, could never improve the value of the property. So it was a no harm, no foul situation. The court said two answers to that. First, we don't understand why somebody would have drafted a deed with that provision in it if, in fact, it would never make a difference, right? Why was that in there if it was always going to be irrelevant? Now, I should add to that, sometimes I've seen legal documents where I think it's pretty clear that the attorney is looking to cover every wild type of weird contingency that may have little chance of happening, but it'll cover them just in case nobody can claim they weren't told and lost all this money. I don't know if that was the case here. The court eventually doesn't think it is, but it's like, yeah, that could be. But remember, if you have something in there, you know, you've got to consider, especially in a case like this with conservation easements, be careful about those sort of protective items in there, because you've got to make sure they're not running you afoul of the requirements to have a qualified conservation easement. But secondly, the court said, and we don't buy the theory anyway, they're not worth anything. We understand the concept that let's say, putting in a sewer line may not cause the value of a piece of property to go up by more than the cost of that sewer line. But they said, taking all the improvements as a whole that Bel Air Woods was going to be allowed to make, it's likely that, yes, it was really crucial to the developments they were going to be doing, and that it would obviously seem to at least reasonably increase the value of that overall property. And so because of that, the court said, no, we don't think it's reasonable. You include it in here for a reason. We're going to assume that. And number two, you never proved to us that all of these improvements together didn't really improve things because you're developing the land. Why are you developing the land? Because presumably, after I'm done developing the property, I can sell the property for more than I would have had I just held the raw land and sent that off later, right? That's otherwise, why would you spend the money on the development? Just let, you know, give them raw land and let the buyers put stuff in, right? That's a concept. So the court didn't buy the whole thing. Now, as I said, Bel Air Woods has been to court three times. They've now lost three times. The real issue here is, and I picked this out because we've done it before. That's why I did it. There have been a series of these losses in conservation easement cases going on all summer. A lot of them are on technicalities. Some of them are on absurdity because the numbers just don't make sense. You know, how could you buy something today for X and a year and a day later, give away just the easement and it be worth 20 times X? It's like, how'd that happen? You know, we don't find that credible. And that sometimes happens, things like that. So we see these other issues where they just don't go with the easement ideas. But we also have seen a bunch of them like this where they just have a foot fault on the documents. You know, if you're going to do conservation easements, the IRS considers them now to have been abused by a lot of people. You got to be very, very careful. And whoever's working with it needs to very carefully check, double and triple check the documents in question. In a lot of these cases, the documents are drawn up by the promoter. You know, don't assume the promoter in drawing up the documents is necessarily doing it all 100% correct. I would always have your own counsel paid separately to take a look at these documents to see that they work the way they're supposed to. Finally, this week, we have the case of Keefe versus Commissioner. This is from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, case numbers 182357 and 182594. The case was decided on July the 17th of 2020. And we have talked about this case when it went through the tax court. Now they're appealing, same issue. The taxpayer had acquired a mansion in Rhode Island. Okay, it was a waterfront mansion. Their theory was, at least they claim, that they plan to restore it. That much makes sense because they did do the restoration. And the idea would be that they would then be able to lease out the property. Well, what happened was, you know, they started doing improvements and it actually ended up taking quite a while. And during the time it was being improved, they did have a few times of trying to rent out the property. However, it never actually got rented. When the improvements were finally completed, you know, never actually tried to rent it after the improvements were done, and later sold the property. This didn't go well for them. So they sold the property for a significant loss. After you considered what they paid for it, the cost of the renovation, they lost significant money in this case. Now, they claimed it was a 1231 loss on the sale of a rental property that would qualify them for an ordinary income deduction. The IRS objected, saying, no, you never had a trade or business. Now, one thing to note here, this is a Second Circuit case. And we do know that the Second Circuit on rentals does have a higher bar. But in many ways, the court didn't even get to the higher bar that we saw in the Greer case we've discussed. We're talking about Section 199 Cap A. Rather, what the court decided was this thing never seriously seemed to have become a rental. And whether that rental be a trade or business or not, it's kind of irrelevant because it never even got there. They're saying, here's your problem. You know, the tax court said it was never really rented and the loss was capital. They appealed that. The Second Circuit agreed. They said, look, here's some problems we've got. You never actually tried to rent the property once it was restored, and you made half-hearted efforts only at renting the property while you were restoring it. So, you know, you weren't there continuously. You didn't try it all the time. It never was successful, right? You listed the property for sale the entire time you had it. Now, they tried to say, wait, Bank of America required us to list it for sale in order to get the loan to finish up the restoration. And the court said, yeah, but what you did all the way through this does not look like it was merely a listing on paper so that you could make the bank happy. You appeared to be seriously trying to sell the property from day one, finding a buyer to take it over. They're saying from that perspective, this looks like a capital asset, not a rental trader business. It's a problem. And finally, they said, here's a third problem you've got. You knew this property could qualify for two tax credits, one at the federal level, one at the state level. However, one of the credits required you to rent the property, you know, to get it to a rental or use in a trader business in order to obtain the credit. The other one did not, just required the restoration. The only one you started working on to qualify for was the one that did not require a rental. You know, it would seem if you truly were planning to rent the property, you would not have said, forget the federal credit because we'd have to rent it. You would have pursued both credits. You knew about both credits, but you only pursued the one that didn't require a rental. And they never actually qualified for any of them, as far as I recall, eventually. But they're saying, but that also indicates that you were not serious about renting the property. So for this reason, this was not a trader business asset. It's not a 1231 loss. And that means the loss is a long-term capital loss, and you're going to be stuck at $3,000 a year because you don't have capital gains to go against it until you later have capital gains, or we finally exhaust at $3,000 a year these losses. So, interesting issue. As I said, Keith lost to the tax court. They went to the Court of Appeals. They've lost again. My guess is there's no way the U.S. Supreme Court's going to care about this case. There's also very little chance that you could get the Second Circuit to hear the case in bonk, because I doubt it's really going to matter to them that way. So you could ask, but it's not likely to happen. So I think in this case, you know, the Keefs are done. It is important because clients especially, and now we're in kind of a down economy in some places, at least some places real estate's down, other places it's not. But, you know, we may see clients suddenly have this property. They're planning to get this big capital gain because they're going to be doing flipping, right? They're trying to claim that they're flipping, but it's really an investment asset, not a business. So it'd be a capital gain. Now we're going to see them change their mind again and try to go the other way. Just recall, you've got to show that you had an actual trader business going on in order to claim that ordinary loss. Well, CPE continues, and I do have some coming up in August. I thought I'd mention a few here for you today. We are going to be doing that New Jersey Society monthly tax update on August the 12th. So if we have a new bill by then, we'll be talking about that there. Otherwise, we'll talk about just whatever else happens or has happened in the month or month plus leading up to the course on the 12th. So if you're a New Jersey Society member, if you're a member, actually I should say just New Jersey CPA, right? It's NJCPA. Officially, they got rid of the S a few years ago. So it's NJCPA. If you're an NJCPA member, I do suggest you take a look at that. You can register for it. I guess if you're not, you can register for it too. So you'll be paying the non-member rate, but, you know, we'll let you come in. It's going to be a webcast, not live, so you don't have to be, you know, on location, which is generally the case for everything we're doing right now. In essence, current conditions in the U.S. do not make it very easy, shall we say, to either travel to a remote location. Right now, if I tried to go to New Jersey from Phoenix, I would have to quarantine for 2 weeks before I could do the session. And it also doesn't make it very easy to actually hold a session with people in it, you know, with very many people in it. And to be totally honest, we don't see that level of comfort among registrants yet to get up there. Some of you may have heard, I heard this week about the story about, you know, they're trying to sell tickets to the Indianapolis 500 that's going to go on late in August. They initially said it would be 50%. Of the tickets. They put tickets out there. They'd let people, you know, who didn't want to come, they could go to apply it to next year, etc. Well, the catch was they did agree to reduce to 25 this week, 25%. But to be totally honest, and yes, it's arguably because it will be easier for the state, it'll be more in line, etc. But the other thing they discovered was they hadn't yet sold 25% of the tickets, even though we're just a few weeks away. And I think that that's what's also hurting us on doing CPE Live right now is, you know, a live course simply right now, there won't be enough people sign up. That's still going to be a problem until we get a lot more confidence about this thing. And that's also going to hurt doing live sessions, regardless of whether or not you can get there. Right. Right now, I can't get there. Where I can get to, but it'll still be a remote session for the second reason, because this is Phoenix. You know, we were COVID central for a while here. We will be doing it on August 13th. I'll be talking about the income taxation of trusts and estates. That's an 8-hour course. I'll then go on the next day, and we'll be doing it planning for the qualified business income deduction on the 14th. And then after that weekend, it's kind of funny, I'm doing a Thursday, Friday, Monday. We'll talk about partnership taxation advanced issues, 8 hours there. Also, as I said, I expect to, if we get a new law, we will be seeing if we can do some actual updates on the new law for various state societies. So, you know, keep an eye out for that as we go. I'll also probably bring up any new law. We'll obviously talk about it here as well. So keep an eye on that stuff coming up. But it is CPE time. And remember, you know, we are going to be heading to the September 15th deadline and things shortly. So might want to try to pick up some CPE in the next few weeks so that you're, you know, ready to go and, you know, get ready for that end of tax season period, and then, you know, pick up after October 15th. This has been Currentville Tax Developments. Remember, we do post updates regularly online at currentvilletaxdevelopments.com. You can check there for our stories. We'll talk to you about things that happen. If we do get a new bill, I will probably have some sort of write-up there about some of the key provisions in the bill, so you can find out what's going on. You can basically send questions or comments to me. My email address, eddollars@currentvilletaxdevelopments.com. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at eddollars. And I do participate in the Connect sites for the Arizona, Minnesota, New Jersey, Washington, and Illinois Society of CPAs. I look in from time to time on Cal CPAs Tax Talk Group, where they have talks nationwide. CPAs can be there. The Connect sites are generally open only to the members of the specific societies. And every so often, I will take a look at the Reddit group. It's /r/taxpros on Reddit. Talk there. So if you want to bounce things around, go look for those locations. If I see your question, I'll see if I can have, I see if I feel capable of responding to it. If I do, I'll try to do so. But it's a great place to go to get, those are great places, I should say, to go to just bounce ideas off other professionals. It can be very useful. Otherwise, we'll wait and see what the week brings. I mean, hopefully we will be on our way to negotiating a new bill, assuming we're getting one by this time next week. And if we're really lucky, we might even have the bill. I don't suspect we'll be quite that lucky, but you never know, maybe. We'll see what's there. And we'll watch for other developments in the next week on taxes. It's been relatively quiet this week. We didn't have a whole lot going on. This was a very quiet week in many ways, but we'll see what comes up next week. And we'll keep our eyes open. So I hopefully will see you back here a week from now, and we'll talk about the new current federal tax developments.